Mental health and wellness are crucial aspects of well-being. Their understanding and acceptance are vital for the progress of society. In a cultural context, mental health is often shrouded in stigma and misunderstanding, leading to a lack of proper support and care for those affected. Heal Your Mind with Tracy Kotzen is a platform for candid conversations that enlighten and enrich our understanding of mental health and wellness. Join us as we demystify, destigmatize, prioritize, and shine a light on mental health and healing. Heal Your Mind podcast with Tracy Kotzen is hosted by Mental Wellness Initiative and supported by the Ford Foundation.
My name is Tracy Kotzen. I am the host of Heal Your Mind with Tracy Kotzen. Today we were talking about neurodivergence and specifically the stigma that is attached to neurodivergent people. Our conversation was broad and we had an incredible set of guests today. And yet what stood out for me was that there are structural elements that uphold stigma, things that sit in institutions, that sit in the way people across the world think about people who are different from themselves. What also emerged for me was that the greatest tool we have against stigma is information. We can only think in the framework of what we already know. If we're going to think differently, we're going to need new information. So I want to challenge educators, parents, employers to think about neurodivergence as, in fact, a strength. Neurodivergent people have an incredible set of gifts that they can contribute to the world. And I'm not talking about the gifts that Hollywood would present in the movie Rain Man is a common reference point. I'm talking about their sense of humor. I'm talking about the way they can love fiercely and selflessly. I'm talking about the way they see the world in ways other people don't. These are gifts and strengths and talents. And if we can find ways to, number one, not be judgmental, not oust people who are neurodivergent, but bring them into spaces, help them find spaces where they can express themselves freely without fear of judgment and recrimination, we will in fact be unleashing an incredible thing in the world, a beautiful thing in the world. So the next time you see a neurodivergent person, the next time you meet a neurodivergent person, if you look in the mirror and that neurodivergent person is you, approach with love, with openness, with kindness, with care, and you will find that you're unwrapping something truly magical. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. This morning, we're speaking about neurodivergence, a massively important conversation as it affects a huge portion of adults and children. And when we look at the stats worldwide, we're finding more and more and more people being diagnosed with neurodivergence in different forms. Today we have with us Dr. Emil Goos. He's a postdoctoral fellow at the University of South Africa and an internationally renowned disability activist. Dr. Goos has represented South Africa at the Commonwealth and United Nations in the context of his activism work for neurodivergence awareness. Welcome, Dr. Goos.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
We also have with us Dr. Nandi Attridge. Nandi is an educational psychologist based in Bryanston, Johannesburg, with extensive experience across both mental health and educational environments. She provides psychotherapy to individuals from early childhood through to adulthood, and her therapeutic approaches focus on helping individuals navigate challenges, build insight, and develop adaptive skills as they move through different life transitions. Welcome, Dr. Nandi.
Thank you very much.
Joining us online, we have Rihanna Erasmus. Rihanna Sate Erasmus is a visionary entrepreneur, I can attest to that, a strategist, healer, and growth architect, transforming the way businesses scale with soul, science, and audacity. With over two decades of experience leading financial services brands across South Africa and beyond our borders, Rihanna has made her mark as a marketing powerhouse before courageously leaving the corporate world to build something different, a life and legacy aligned to purpose. Welcome, Ray, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we have these three very experienced, highly credentialed guests in studio today. And yet we're talking about something that is so close to our hearts, right? It's not necessarily an academic conversation. It's a soul and heart conversation about something that hurts people and that long term in the macro view actually hurts the country at the level of how effective are we as a nation state if we don't have proper responses to neurodivergence. We know there's a great gifting amongst the neurodivergent community and they can make such profound and beautiful contributions to society. If we shroud them in stigma, we will never be able to draw those gifts out. If we shroud them in stigma, we will forever create more wounding for people who are already struggling. And we won't be able to equip the institutions that are meant to be supporting these folks or equipping their families even. Before we go any further, Dr. Host, can you give us a broad definition of what is neurodivergence?
Neurodivergence is a beautiful concept that refers to the difference and the diversity of the different brain types in society. Where neurodivergence comes in is refers to different forms of different kinds of neurodiversities referring to the individual. So when you look particularly at autism, when you look at dyslexia, alexia, and ADHD, they fall under this neurodivergence concept. But neurodiversity refers to the different variations of the brain, and you will find that different kinds of differences, different kinds of brain types, in fact, all of them, which the all classification referred to the all, to the different invisible impairments, which includes Down syndrome as well. But let me tell you that the neurodiversity movement started in 1998 and was coined by a lady named Judy Singer, who from Australia, who was an autism South advocate as well. And you saw that when we refer to the disability activism movement, we are referring now to human rights and that these individuals can be able to cope. These individuals can participate in society free from different forms of discrimination, victimization. And the neurodiversity movement is referring to different brain types, but it's within a broader concept of diversity and human rights.
Beautiful. That was phrased. You opened by saying it is a beautiful, and I loved that. I love that we didn't immediately start sticking labels and stigma all over the thing we're trying to destigmatize. Thank you for framing it as a beautiful thing of. So, and when I picture it like a rainbow that has a great many more than seven colors. That it's shades of the way we function as human beings. Sadly, we tend to create boxes. I'm not a fan of putting humans in boxes, but somehow we do this with incredible proficiency as a society. And then we decide which boxes are the normal boxes and which boxes are the not normal boxes. And so it's actually a bit of a, like an artificial separation, right? This construct of normal, not normal is an artificial separation when we should be looking at what is the ebb and flow of the way humans function differently and how we place humans in a space or how they locate themselves in a space rather that draws out their greatest talents, their greatest gifts, their greatest ability to contribute. And underpinning that, the belief that every person has the ability to contribute to society in whatever capacity. So I want to come across to Dr. Nandi. You work with children. Can you tell us a little bit more about, so it's a double question, what sort of stigmas do children come across in the schooling system? And how do they find you, or how do you find them to help parents, families figure out what is going on with the kid and then build support around that?
Thank you for that, Tracy. I just want to correct, I'm not a doctor yet. I will be one day, but not just yet. Okay. In terms of your question, I think what tends to happen within society is that we want to create labels. Some people do, some people don't. We have two ends of the pendulum over there. Some people want to form an identity through a label. Mm-hmm. And other people don't want that label because they don't want to be put into that box. Right. What I try and do is I try and see it from the perspective of what is the difficulty that the child is finding difficult to navigate within either the home environment or within the school environment. And from there, take a step back and say, okay, what is this hampering in their life? How are they not reaching their full potential? And then equipping them with a skill set to try and have them reach that full potential in a way of not masking. So as society, we want to create a sense of predictability, routine. Mm. That's what we thrive on. I always say to my parents that we have a certain expectation of individuals, not just children. And when they don't meet those expectations, we become dysregulated because we don't know how to navigate that space. How I come into the conversation is I work a lot with schools, various different schools, underprivileged schools, very privileged schools. And the common theme is that there's no manual. We don't know how to navigate a space where there's unknown territory. Mm. And so I walk that journey with them. And that's really what I specialize in, is that this is not a one size fits all. Mm. It's how do we take this journey together? I work very closely with various practitioners, occupational therapists, remedial therapists, speech therapists. Teachers are so valuable. Mm. And also with parents, each one brings insight into this picture that we're trying to form of this child to understand them better. Mm. I often go into classrooms and we look at how is a child regulating or how are they not regulated, and how do we integrate that within the classroom where they're not stigmatized, where they're not judged, and they're not made to feel different. Rather, they integrated into that environment and they normalize what it is that they're experiencing.
Hmm. Thanks, Dr. Nandu. Well, not Dr. Nandu. I'm going to have to unsay it now. But Nandi is an educational psychologist with aspirations to be Dr. Nandi. Yay. I love that. So let's take a step back, because you said something that hits a controversial nerve. Some people like the labeling because it helps them find identity, and you feel like I'm not making it up. Like it gives me a sense of understanding, right? Because there's some descriptors in this label that help me understand myself better. And then there are people who kick against the label because they don't want to be confined, limited within that. And I want to bring that across to Ray, because Ray and I have had this conversation in separate contexts. And Ray, you'll share more, but for context is when you started understanding the patterns of your own neurodivergence, it actually helped you understand yourself better. So can you share some more around what was the difference between not having the diagnosis / label, and we may want to split hairs on that a bit later, versus then having that and that giving you access to more information?
I think this has been quite a profound time in my life. Not only am I in my 40s and nearing my mid 40s, but the body is also responding differently now. She is going through early menopause and so many things are happening. And like most women who are diagnosed late in life, they learn about their neurodiversity through their children. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing for me. So my son was diagnosed when he was 10 years old. He's 18 now. And so I always knew there was something different about myself, but I couldn't put my finger on what it was. And the more I learned how to support him through his neurodiversity and neurodivergent journey, I learned about myself. And through this process, I started to understand myself better. Why I needed to go for the assessment for myself was because I am the type of individual that actually needs that kind of clarity and that kind of affirmation. So it was less of wanting to have a label, but more of wanting to be certain about what I already knew about myself. And so how this has helped me now is that I can now take accountability for my own journey. But it's no longer just about supporting my child and his journey or my other child and her journey, because I can see those differences coming through her now as well, because she's also just gone through puberty, but we can speak about that in another podcast.
About how indeed.
Neurodivergence plays out in women who are going through major hormonal shifts in their lives. It definitely shows up differently in boys and men than it does in girls and women. And having this clarity is not about having a label, but it is about understanding parts of me, because these labels also don't define me. But it is understanding how parts of me actually work. So I understand how the parts of my brain works, and I also now understand how it impacts my nervous system. I also understand what I need to do in order to support myself through this journey. So I've had to educate myself on my brain and other parts of my anatomy, which I actually love. And through this, I am getting to know myself better, and I can support myself better. So what is the difference now? Now I act from a place of clarity and from understanding and from regulation, emotional regulation, nervous system regulation. And so it is the information and the knowledge coupled with the practice and the disciplines and the rhythms that I've put in place for myself now, that has changed my life remarkably, because this is who I am. This is my brain. This is how it operates. And it's best I get to know how to live with this in my body.
Yes, how to work the machine.
Right, how to work the machine. And so this is like my new obsession. It is understanding the brain and understanding how that works together with the nervous system and then all the other parts of your body. And it's been the most magical experience for me. So it hasn't really been about the titles. It's not to be put in a box or to have a label. It's just enabled me to understand myself better. And so I can show up in boardrooms and healing spaces with this degree of information, but also experience within myself. So not only can I lead better or hold sacred space for healing better, I myself am now a better human. I'm more grounded. I can show up better in spaces. And it's not like this all of the time. Sometimes I am a complete mess, but I also understand that that is also part of who I am. I'm not trying to hold it all together all the time anymore. I allow myself to be whatever I need to be at whatever time I find that in.
Thank you, Ray. It sounds like you are writing the operating manual for yourself, which is fantastic. I wish that we arrived on the planet with operating manuals. That would be amazing.
Well, that wouldn't be fun, now, would it?
No, it wouldn't. It really wouldn't. It wouldn't be fun.
It would be so boring.
Emil, you are now a postdoctoral fellow, but it's been a hell of a road to get there. From the point of view of creating enabling and capacitating environments for neurodivergent people, how did you get from where you started to where you are? And can you walk us through a little bit of that journey?
Now, listening to what Ravonel said, that's a classic example of how the autism diagnosis can empower you.
Mm-hmm.
The power of understanding who you are,
mm-hmm.
and understanding the contribution of your uniqueness can have in different parts of society. And I think what contributes towards our understanding is the fact that being late diagnosed is rather a privilege as a disadvantage, because we are living in a time where the autism, where the research in the field of neurodiversity, there's a lot more research that are being published. There's a lot more self-advocates like Ravana, a lot more females, which we refer to always as the lost generation, and the major contribution that they make. It's quite fascinating to see how these individuals can function. But referring to myself, referring to my personal experience, It's been a journey. And, you know, like you said, I want to go back to your introduction because it's a very personal matter. It's a matter which a lot of people get hurt. It's a matter where there's a lot of anxiety, where there's a lot of mental health challenges. And I know that we're going to come to that question, but I want to refer to, you know, we are currently in a crisis when it comes to neurodiversity in South Africa because research has shown that we've got higher suicide rate of neurodiverse individuals in the world. And the living age of an autistic person in South Africa is 35 years old.
Wow.
Due to depression, anxiety, and suicide is prominent. And referring to my personal experience, I experienced a lot of these experiences from being isolated in society, from being labeled as a non-functioning individual. I've been in a situation where, especially in my primary school years, where a specialist teacher tied up my hands because of my difference, because I couldn't communicate. And referring to the classic definition of autism, and which people refer to the label of the low-functioning individuals, communication is a prominent challenge and throughout the individual's lives, but I was non-speaking until the age of 15, and then, you know, speech development, and I'm now in my 6th, 7th year of full communication in full sentences.
Amazing.
But it's been a long journey. And when you refer to neuroplasticity, where the brain develops all of these skills, where the brain develops these skills simultaneously, where an individual can function with support, and we've got Ms. Kimix who supports us. We've got a social media page called Special Need Cafe. But we, and with myself and Sammy, who's also a semi-verbal autistic individual, but, you know.
And also your wife.
She's my beautiful wife.
Yes, she is.
Yes. You know, we show that these individuals can function, and referring to our personal experiences, it's been a long journey from being isolated in a formal school environment, received therapy from the age of 3.5 years to the age of 9 years, being in a remedial school environment as well, being supported, with my late mom, and to be able to function in your own way from being at the point where I tried to commit suicide a couple of years ago. And through autism self-advocacy, I got that self-acceptance later on in my life, to be able to cope in different environments, to be able to understand why did I struggle to communicate? Why did I struggle to function? And I must say that neuroplasticity was present, but the most fundamental thing that I want to remind parents and practitioners as well is support. To make your support base strong, because it's a lifelong journey. It's a journey where you achieve a lot of milestones. There's a journey where you feel that you will make progress, you will develop, but the next day, you would take 3 steps back, but that's how it works. And yeah, so I would say it's a long journey, and with continuous support, these individuals will be able to achieve their goals.
Thanks, Sumail. I want to cross-pollinate what you've said back to Nandi, and Emil, you're welcome to jump back in again. In fact, Ray as well, because it's a cross-cutting thing. In a world where the root of stigma is shame, and the root of shame is some idea that, I'm talking about families specifically now, and this is a very broad statement, so please no one shoot me, but I'm trying to center this. In a world where if we produce children that are different, the family is shamed by society often, right? And I know across across cultures in South Africa that can be quite prominent. And so the shame is internalized for the parents. And within that shame, there's a rejection of the child, but there's also a rejection of themselves because they produced a child that didn't somehow meet society's expectations of what a child is supposed to be. How do we get them to flip from shame to support? Because support means we're embracing the child, the difference. We're embracing ourselves as a family. Versus shame, which is a rejection function. How do we flip that over? Nandi, I'm going to start with you and then the rest of you can jump in as we go.
So I've worked in a remedial school environment, and I think that environment provided me with so much knowledge in terms of the experience that not only the child goes through, but the parents. Mm. And a lot of it goes around Kubler-Ross in terms of the grief. And it's a process that we go through, and we try and bargain, we try and reason. And through all of that, we reach a point where we are accepting of putting our child in a smaller environment. It's not different. It's the same curriculum in most instances. But what we don't do is take a step back and say, what does my child actually need versus what do we expect of them? Mm. When they don't meet that expectation, that's when the shame comes in because we're not fitting this box. Mm. When we embrace that difference, then we're able to accept a lot more and support them in whatever their journey looks like, not the expected journey that we want from them. Right. And it's to be accepting of support. So within our society, we're not always accepting of support because it is still deemed a vulnerability and a weakness. If we're able to embrace that and say, actually, I can't do this on my own. And in Ubuntu, we do this as a team, as a village, and we raise this child to be the best that they can be.
So you're saying meet the child where they are, not where you wish they were, in a nutshell. Ray, do you want to come in on that?
Absolutely. It is my current lived experience at the moment. And, you know, just bearing in mind that my official diagnosis was only received last year. And so I've kind of been living with this new affirmed knowledge about myself for about a year now, right? And so even though I had this diagnosis of my son, diagnoses, because he's had many diagnoses in this past while, my honest truth is I couldn't see myself, my son, for who he was. I was still looking at him through my, I'm going to call it undiagnosed eyes, because this is the moment that changed my life. And I feel like that moment was so defining for me as a mother, because everything that you've just mentioned, Tracy, it came to me like the floodgates were just opened, and I saw every moment in his life that I knew he was different, and every moment in his life that I didn't accept him for who he was. And so not only did it come with shame, it also came with such deep guilt. Guilt for being his mom and not being able to see him, really see him. And my diagnosis has been able to show me the parts of myself that is just like him. The parts of myself that I've been covering up, you know, so that I can survive and provide and show up as a leader, the leader that I thought I had to be. And my journey in this has been trying to figure myself out now, but also trying to just hold space for my son. And I think that's probably the biggest job and title that I have, is holding space for my son. It is not easy. I had to take him out of school. He was just not coping in school. Despite being at a private institution, he's been to so many institutions, even remedial institutions. And It's just not for him. And I have to honor him, you know, in this process of beingness and self-discovery, just as I am going through my own journey of self-discovery. And every day, it is a learning and an unlearning at the same time, because I'm still shedding those parts of me that is still defined by society and so many other parts of me that I have learned to learn. And it is hard. I don't think that there is ever a flipping of the script, Tracy. There isn't ever a flipping of how do we flip from shame. There's only a walking through, an acknowledgement, a witnessing. Not only our shame, but also our ancestral shame, and that the generations before us had to walk in and to hide from, because they didn't have the information like we do today. They didn't have spaces and environments where they could show up fully as themselves. And so we're not only dealing with our shame or the shame of our children, but also many generations before us. And so that honoring for me is not only honoring my own shame, but also that of my son and everybody that came before me in this journey of learning myself and embracing who I am.
Thank you, Ray. Now, this is why it is a personal conversation, because while we have professional passions in the space, it's deeply about who we are as humans, as moms, as families, and then later on our secondary identity as advocates for this work. Jay, thank you for letting us see your heart on this topic and for being vulnerable in the space. What you just shared now is going to make a huge, huge difference for other parents who are going to hear this and are sitting with everything you've just said, but sitting with it in silence and secrecy. So thank you for opening the door for those conversations for them. I deeply appreciate that. I want to come across from Ray to Emil. Emil, stigma is built in the structures of the way we view things as a society, right? And Ray currently has just expressed, and I'm going to massively paraphrase it, but she's living in the consequences of those structural elements that produce these notions of stigmatization. And for people who don't necessarily understand what we mean when we say stigma, I'm going to break it down to you feel judged. You feel like you're being hyper-criticized. You can feel picked on and you feel different, giving you a sense of not belonging to something that other people seem to belong to easily. And people don't treat you the way they treat others. So it's not a great feeling. And of course, it comes with wanting to now further hide yourself away so as to avoid more of these feelings and treatments that come with stigma. When we look at the macro level, because you work at the global, international level around this work, what is it that we need to deconstruct and reconstruct or unlearn to relearn at macro level for stigma to be broken down all the way through to community level? What is the stuff that's holding it up?
I first need to thank Rwanda for your story, because you showed yourself, which is real. And we need people to be real, to be honest about the experience. And the biggest challenge that we have in society is the fact that education plays a major part, not only referring on an education level, on a school level, but I'm referring to globally, on macro level and the different levels of education in terms of understanding. Because when you understand, when you appreciate, when you listen to these stories, you will be able to implement the necessarily reasonable accommodations. You know, Tracy, that this field, like I mentioned before, and like you mentioned also, is, you know, it's very personal, and the majority of the autistic individuals themselves, who either been diagnosed or later been diagnosed, have been victims of discrimination, victimization. The mental health challenges that these people experience, the post-traumatic stress of parents, you know, is real, you know, and unfortunately these individuals are at the space where they don't have a purpose. You know, that is what 95% of autistic individuals, neurodiverse individuals experience in South Africa, do not have a purpose. And that is based on a lack of education, a lack of understanding. And look, coming back to South Africa, we've got the best policies in the world. You know, this new D20 summit produced a policy where different stakeholders are contributing towards a big statement. You've got the best policies in the world. When you look particularly at the UNCRPD, the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which South Africa has signed in 2007 and adopted in our constitution, which the White Paper 6 is based from, and the different white papers on education and inclusivity in different spaces. It's all there. But the biggest challenge is policy compliance versus policy reliance. You can have the best policies in the world, but if it's not implemented, and if people are not understanding it, you won't be able to provide the reasonable accommodations, the necessary support for these individuals, then it won't work. So look, we came far. We've got more stories that are coming out. We've got autistic individuals, neurodiverse individuals that are sharing their personal stories. Yeah. They are doing more research on this. And there's a new programs like this podcast that are trying to educate people. But if it's not being implemented, I always say that people accommodate what they see. For instance, a person in a wheelchair or a visually impaired person. But what you can't see, you won't be able to accommodate. And look, myself and Sammy, you know, and of course a lot of neurodivergent individuals are being excluded in various avenues. When you think of broader society, for instance, and for instance at the restaurant where they're not allowing a autism support dog, based on the fact that there's not there's a lack of understanding why this individual needs this specific reasonable accommodations, workspaces to make things more accessible, accommodating the sensory challenges visually, auditively. That is specific things that people do not see. And empathy, understanding. For me, what I found is that people who's got a personal experience, people who either has a sibling or individuals who are diagnosed themselves, or individuals who's got some form of understanding of neurodiversity, or those that are willing to accommodate. And we need that often.
Okay. If you can't see it, you can't make accommodations for it. So we need to get people to see it. And I'm going to broaden the definition of seeing it to see the signs, to see the clues, to see beyond your own eyes, which means get information, get education, be awake to the world, right? Be awake to other human beings, and not through some straw-width lens, but a much broader lens of human functioning. And that's not formal education, right? That's just humans waking up to other humans. We're nearly out of time, so I'm going to give us a minute each to wrap up. Nandi, go. You've got your minute.
So I just want to say thank you for this opportunity. It is empowering to be able to be a part of these important conversations that people are not exposed to. What I want to try and do is encourage parents, teachers, schools, therapists, practitioners, and everyone in society to get involved, to be aware of your own vulnerabilities and realize how that impacts the way in which we see the world, and be open to the journey looking different to the one that you had planned.
Right.
And trust. I know trust is a very hard thing to earn, but get your team together, work with them, and walk the journey together. You are not alone. And whilst many people don't understand, there's good people in the world who want to walk with you and support you. Allow them to. It's not a weakness. It's a strength to ask for help and accept help.
Mm. Absolutely. You couldn't have said it better. Thank you, Nandi. Emil, a minute.
Neurodiverse people needs to be seen, heard, and understood. I want parents to understand that your child is unique. Your child can contribute. There's a lot of examples where neuroplasticity is involved, where the brain develops new skills, and with the proper support, your child will be able to achieve their goals. It just takes time, patience, and understanding. And also remember to not compare your child's journey with someone else, because they are molded and built and developed. They develop in their own unique way, and there will always be a place for them to contribute towards society.
Thank you. Ray, wrap us up.
Yeah, I think in closing for me, I just want to use your segue of, you know, seeing, being seen. I think for me, it's just being, you know, being, just being neurodivergent, just being human, being in spaces where there are others like me who are different. I would like to have more of that. I would like to have more opportunities where my son can find social platforms and in-person platforms where he can also just be himself with others like him. And maybe this is my next lot in life, is to not just speak. This is my first time speaking as a neurodivergent, by the way. So this is taking a lot of bravery and courage for me to speak up, and I'm very vulnerable. But it's probably not going to be the last, you know. There are not many spaces for us to just be ourselves freely. And I wish there were more of that. I wish there were more opportunities for support. And sometimes all we need is just to be together, you know. It doesn't even need to be in a therapeutic environment. It is just to be and to be free in that moment. So that's me in closing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you for reminding us to just be, you know, being human. I've concluded that the purpose of my life is to live. You know, I used to think I had some higher purpose that involved, I don't know, saving the world a little bit somewhere, but how egotistical when you're in your 20s, right? And I've arrived at my purpose on this planet is to live wholly and fully and beautifully. And if we can kind of all just get there, we will inherently just appreciate the differences within each other. And my prayer and my hope is that we will arrive there with you good people doing amazing activism work. Keep breaking down and reconstructing, you know, let's not reconstruct the barriers, but break them down and then construct some avenues for change. It's been a privilege and an honor to have you with me this morning. And I thank you all so much for your truth, your honesty, your vulnerability. It has been beautiful and extraordinary, and I thank you.
Heal Your Mind podcast with Tracy Cotson is hosted by Mental Wellness Initiative and supported by the Ford Foundation.